Thank you for keeping the flies fly.
Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop would like to send a big shout out to the First Lady of Hip Hop, MC Sha-Rock. Sharon Jackson, as a pioneering female, you set a standard and opened doors. We may never fully gauge the depth of your influence on hip hop as a culture. Salute with full honors, Queen Sha-Rock.
So nice, so that's what I like.
I say to him, how can you just don't stop it and just get ready to jam? The Disco Daddy Wide World of Hip Hop Radio Show. Every Saturday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, only on 5Live.com, with special guests every week. Don't miss it.
Hello out there, Disco Daddy here. Welcome to another edition of Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop. And as you know, you've been following us all the month of September. We've been honoring our queens of the culture, the sisters who have been with us and down with hip hop from the very beginning of hip hop. Sometimes their contribution is overlooked or minimized. Our honoring them this month addresses that misrepresentation in history, because they really all have stories to tell. You've heard some very interesting stories all of this month from a lot of the lady pioneers. And as always, before we begin this interview with Miss Celia Powell Bodis, formerly known as MC High C, we want to give a shout out to the First Lady of Hip Hop, MC Sha-Rock, who couldn't be here with us this month because I interviewed her earlier, but she told me specifically, I really want my other lady friends' stories to shine. And she shows how much of a gracious queen she is. You know, she knows a lot of the ladies aren't getting the publicity, recognition they deserve. So shout out to you, queen. And right now, the latest lady we are honoring this month, queen of the culture for sure, her name is Celia Powell Bodis. She was known as MC High C, and she goes back to the very beginning of hip-hop and has a unique story to tell about the inner-city disco, what that was all about, and what that period was like, transitioning from disco to hip-hop and the resistance to it and acceptance to it by some. So, Miss Celia Powell Bodis, MC High C, how you doing?
I'm doing fine, Disco Daddy. How about yourself?
Good. I didn't put you to sleep with that long introduction, did I?
No, you did not. Actually, it was quite interesting. And, again, shout out to Sha-Rock. She was number one, and I can honestly say I was number two.
There you go. There you go. Well, that's why you're here on this show. You're definitely a queen of the culture. You're known within hip-hop. This show is Love Hip-Hop, who follow me and want to know the truth. We interview legends and get the story, their slice of hip-hop from their own mouth. So we're going to let you fly. Start from the very beginning, where you grew up, where you were born, what it was like, what the flavor was going on, and how you fell into becoming MC High C, Miss Celia Powell Bodis.
Well, just thank you first and foremost for this opportunity. It's amazing that 40 years after the fact that somebody's seeking out my story regarding hip-hop and MC and rapping and the hip-hop culture and what that was all about from my perspective. When I tell people that's what I did, you know, they look in amazement. Some, you know, they bow down and they want me to bust a rhyme and all this other good stuff. But you know, I'm just amazed as to what has happened with the culture from my perspective, being there on ground zero. I was born and raised in the Bronx, New York, home of the hip hop. I was there. I watched it all come to life. I would say mid-70s, 1976, 1977 is when it hit our neighborhood. I was born and raised in a New York City project, Eden Wall Project, which is touted as one of the largest housing developments in New York.
Wow.
Birthplace of a lot of things, and hip hop was one of them. Northeast Bronx is where we started, where a lot of the hip hop movement, well, at that time was B-boys. It was about the B-boys.
Okay, what was going on? What was going on at this point? You're in high school, I assume.
Yes, I was in high school, exactly. It was my first year.
So what exactly was going on? I mean, partying, what was your, exactly, what the flavor was? Let people know
the
exactly
flavor.
What you were doing with a high school kid, a black young high school teenager. What was the thing going on during that period?
The thing going on in that period of time was house parties, center parties, street parties. People were partying. There were block parties anywhere that you can hook up a turntable, two turntables, homemade systems. People were just exploding. It was just an explosion of an expression of a new music movement. And anybody can participate. If you were willing or able, if you had the money, if you had the means, you could get in the game. If you had talent, you could get in the game. But it really started for me was the breakdancing. Breakdancing was the initial entry into the hip-hop culture.
What year was this for you? What year was this?
For me, 1977.
Okay.
We were wearing sweatshirts. With names on them because we belonged to crews. There were crews. There were groups of people who hung together that, you know, went to parties together, that dressed alike, that, you know, had dance routines, you know, showing up at parties. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where the initial hip-hop started for me.
So you started as a B-girl.
I was a B girl. Yes, I was. I still was
okay.
A B girl. Thank you for that term. Yes, I was a B girl.
Well, again, we've had a lot of the New York pioneers like yourself break it down to what burning was. Why don't you give us your description of what it wasn't called breakdancing then?
The term
burning then was maybe a couple of years before
somebody.
You.
When you burn somebody, when you are burning, that means you outdance somebody. That's what that term meant was. That you showed up and you showed out.
Right. The crowd loved you. Okay.
Yeah.
Got you.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're out there, you're a B girl, you're hanging, and then you're looking at the DJs and the MCs. Exactly what pulled you from the B-girl? Where did the transition begin, and how did it begin?
The transition began at house parties for me. I always had a little talent in writing poetry. I always liked to write poetry and rhyme. Growing up, I thought I was a poet. And then we would have house parties in the projects, and people would break out their homemade systems. And I would get invited. And it just happened to be a microphone. And I just happened to get on the mic and do the to the beat, y'all. I'm like, well, I can do the to the beat, y'all. And you don't stop. And that's where it began, was house parties. And then I began to get invited.
When did you start rapping? The same year, 77? Or was it the next year, 78? When did you start actually feeling that?
I would say I started feeling it around 77 was the breakdance and the center parties and all of that going on, and then it transitioned into actually becoming somewhat of a rap artist or an MC.
Let me ask you a very important question. Most of the people start as rap artists or B-boys or B-girls and everything. Now, 77... obviously, you had DJ Flash and you had some other crews out there.
Mm-hmm.
Were there more prominent group rappers by 78 than there was in 77? Were there more groups that had become cohesive units, in other words, rapping by 78, more so than 77? So the B-girl, B-boy period was preceded the period of the explosion.
That's correct. From my perspective and my experience, that's correct.
Right.
From the B-boy
okay,
movement.
So you were there. That's why it's important for people like you to nail these things down, because there was a progression. A lot of people under the impression, MC Hi-C, that hip-hop just exploded and everything was there at once.
No.
You see what I'm saying?
And
all the elements. So that's why our shows are important, people like you. So you get into, you start rapping.
What was it like?
Did you know any other female rappers? MC Shyrock, she was active. Had you met her? And
sure.
What was the acceptance level of female? Was it hard? You know what I'm saying? To prove yourself, to get in with the guys. Go into all of that for us, please.
Well, here's one important factor that I would like to bring to the attention of the audience. In the initial stages of hip-hop, the DJ was the featured artist, and the MCs were the backup. Okay,
right.
So when we went to a party, you went to see the DJ, and the MCs were just accessories. And then it flipped. But getting back to your point of the more prominent group, actually, the first rap group that I actually was a part of a cohesive rap group, lived on the same block as Breakout, which that was Sha-Rock's DJ. That was the group that she was part of, the 54 at that point in time. The group that I was with was Touch of Class, which had the same format, four guys, and I was the one girl. So we kind of mirrored what the Breakout with the Funky Four group did at that time. And I knew some of those MCs. I grew up with Raheem when he was with Breakout.
Very interesting.
Before he went with Flash. So I was familiar with some of those players in that game, because where I lived, everybody came through. You know, you came through, you know, my neighborhood. So we interfaced with each other. Now, as far as Sha-Rock was the only, she was the first female rap artist that I was exposed to that was on the level that, you know, she was the first female rap artist. For me, in my recollection, historically recounting, she was the first female rap artist. And so when I came aboard, I was number two. And I had to distinguish myself from her craft. I didn't want to sound like her, because she had already had her position. And I would have, you know, I never disrespected her, but I had to make a point that I was not her. Now, as far as acceptance in it being a male-dominated, you know, art form at that time, acceptance, I was accepted because of the way that I bought my craft. I always kept it ladylike.
Okay.
I never rapped hardcore per se, like the dudes were. I always kept it on a female, a very feminine level, so I was accepted as a female rapper, you know, a female MC, and wanted to always carry that image wherever we would go and perform. So I was accepted. I had people who would follow me just wherever we gigged or wherever we, you know, we would rock. They would come and they would call Heisketeers. So, you know, they would hype it up. So, there's an acceptance.
Okay. Now, tell us about the Inner City Disco. Were you were part of that? I hope I'm not confusing you with any other.
Oh, no. Oh, yes. No,
okay,
I was part of Inner City Disco.
Where does this phase come in? What is Inner City Disco? What was it? And how did it come together? What year are we talking? You've been rapping for how long before this?
About a year.
Okay.
So 1979. That 1979 is the year that I was introduced to the Inner City Disco. I was introduced into Inner City Disco because my last group kicked me out because I wasn't accepted in the group any longer. So a good DJ line, they were about to cut a record, and for whatever reason, they didn't want my voice on it. So that was their loss.
Well, we're gonna get into that next, how records and recording contracts change the game from the period you're talking about now. That's why you're on the show, too, because you reach both periods. So go ahead, continue.
Exactly. So once the group decided that they were not going to allow me to cut the record with them, they, you know, asked me to leave. They cut me out the group. And I had a really good DJ friend from Mount Vernon. His name was DJ Kenny Ken. He believed in me. He believed in my gift. And he had connections with Inner City Disco. He knew Gail. And so he had set up a meeting. Inner City Disco came out of Left Rack City, Queens, New York. Now, mind you, I lived in Bronx, New York. And I had to ride a train to get all the way out to Queens, New York, but we made it happen. And so he introduced me.
The F train.
All the way out. At least a two-hour ride.
I grew up in New York. I'm familiar. I got you.
So you know.
I used to go with a girl out there in Hollis. So it was a long ride in the wintertime.
Long ride.
But go ahead. I'm sorry, FC Hollis.
That's okay, but at least you get to ride on the train versus, you know, the newer IND trains versus the old IRT train.
That was the old one, believe me. This was the 60s. I'm old school. I was born in Lincoln Hospital, the Bronx, went to PS100 in Harlem, PJHS 117, and Brandeis, when Brandeis first opened up. When it first opened up, and I got kicked out and finished school at Theodore Roosevelt, the Bronx. So go ahead. You're talking to a homie, MC High C. Go ahead with your story.
Okay.
Inner City Disco.
Okay.
MC High C, y'all, on Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop.
In the house. So he brought me over to Queens, and they had a mic set up. You know, I was a little nervous. You know, they wanted me to do my little audition, and that I did, and they made the decision that they wanted me to join the group on the spot. The beauty of this was that there was a gentleman by the name of Pops who believed in the Inner City Disco group. He was, you know, a producer. He was a financier of a lot of things that he did. He took our gift and our talents to another level. He made sure that we were uniformed. He bought us, you know, nice outfits. You know, that was when Gloria Vanderbilt is what it was. Mm-hmm. Gloria Vanderbilt jeans and Sassoon jeans and all of that. He made sure that when we performed, we were top notch. We had a lot of class with our presentation. We felt so proud. To be able to go out there and to do our thing. That was the beginning of it, and we just clicked. The vibe between us all was just, it was phenomenal. Gail had left at that point in time. She had transitioned from Mercedes Ladies, was spanked. She had very strong vocals, little sweet. Again, very strong vocals, and then Baby D, very strong vocals, and then we had Quenny Quinn, who was a beast on the ones and twos. It's something I've never seen before and never seen. I've never seen anybody rock like this chick and have never seen again. She rocked Apache blindfolded, back and forth.
Wow.
Oh, back and forth.
Wow.
That was our weapon. Secret weapon. Put blindfolds on her back and forth.
Even
never
thinking about the image of a female or any DJ doing that is, we're getting her on the show too, but that is fantastic to hear somebody describe that. Okay.
It was phenomenal. So, you know, you put these four females together. We were all Scorpios, I think, except for Quinn, who I believe was a Sagittarius. So she was right in, you know, all in that same, you know, astrological field.
I'm going to interrupt you here. What group was established first, Mercedes Ladies or Inner City Disco?
Mercedes Ladies was established first.
Okay.
Yes.
Go ahead. Just want to get this chronology down. Okay.
Sure. To my recollection, yes, they were the first female, all-female rap group.
Gotcha.
And then, you know, we We were. I don't know if we were one or two or wherever we were, but we were, and we were a force to be reckoned with.
Unsung.
So we got gigs. We would play at the T Connection was our favorite spot. We got some, you know, pretty good recognition.
Were you able to go? Because I understand in the beginning, everybody jammed in their own neighborhood. At a certain point, people were going from obviously Queens to the Bronx and your inner city disco. So were you going to Harlem and different? You know what I'm saying? Was it more?
We were going a lot to like the lower east side of the Bronx. We were playing at there was a it wasn't the garage world renowned garage that was down in the Village, but there was another garage that was in the southeast section of the Bronx. And so we would play.
You had your own crews, DJs, and sound system?
Yes, we did. We had the whole setup. Pop made sure that we had everything that we needed. Our main place where we gig was the T Connection in the Bronx. Now here's the thing.
Okay.
This group is coming out of Queens. I don't think we've ever performed in Queens except for at a house party. We would be in the Bronx.
Plus, it took a few years for Russell Simmons and the whole Queens thing to really sort of percolate and explode over anyway. Okay?
Definitely.
And so Russell was DJing up there in the Bronx. So he was still go ahead. Finish your point. I want to get into how recording contracts changed the game. But go ahead. Finish your point.
The unfortunate thing was that, you know, coming from the Bronx, the home of hip hop, we thought we owned it all. So, you know, it wasn't received when Queens decided that they wanted to join in. But, you know, it is what it is.
Right. That's history now. But records come out. The first records come out, King Tim, and then Rapper's Delight. And all of a sudden, all of you guys who were doing this for fun, what happened?
what happened was you needed to have money to do that. That was the first thing. Unfortunately, a lot of us didn't get paid. You know, we have promises of getting paid, but when, you know, the end of the night came, you know, money disappeared. You had to have money, you know, you had to have the money to be able to, you know, burn that wax. And a lot of us disappeared. When hip hop went to that next level, the DJ disappeared. When they started recording, the DJ disappeared. Now he's in the back where
the MC was the front man.
The MC, that was a major transition. And so, you know, if you didn't have the connections, if you didn't have the biggest name, because at that time it was the biggest names that, you know, got the wax. And you had to know, you know, you had to have those connections. So if you didn't have those connections, you got lost. People were, they wanted to hear who was on the radio now. So, you know, that was big time. So if you weren't on the radio, and the way you got on the radio is that you got a record. And if you didn't get a record, you wasn't, you know, it was lost. So that was a major transition.
Man, right there, you just dropped a big bomb, because only someone who saw and lived that can even describe that transition period like that. You know what I'm saying? How
because
since New York was first, all your rappers were there, and the first record contracts were given there, to know that all of you guys who were out there in the park jams, putting your heart and soul and energy in this because you just loved this new form, now corporate corporations start coming in with contracts of money. And so
they saw what we didn't see. Because there's no way at that time, if you would have told me that hip hop would be what it was today, I would not have believed you. Because we thought it was a fad. We thought it was just a trend. We thought it was something that was going to come and go. But to see where it is now, it's phenomenal. You know, we couldn't fathom that at that stage.
Right.
So, you know.
Well, let me ask you.
Sure.
What is Miss Celia Powell Brodus, MC High C, doing these days?
Oh, okay. Well, after I retired at the age of 18, because I felt that I was too old to, you know, be a part of the hip hop rapping game.
At 18, you were too old.
At 18, I was too old.
And that was because of the transitions that were taking place that you just described.
It was part of that, and then I just felt like I needed to do something else with my life. I didn't see a future.
Okay.
No future.
Okay.
So I was always, you know, looking for a way to better myself and to, you know, move forward in life. And so I went to college after that and moved to Richmond, Virginia. I am an entrepreneur at this point. I own an accounting firm. I'm a CPA. So I'm a professional, and I've been independent for 10 years, and I've worked in the accounting field every bit of 30. So all my work in life has been about numbers.
Which I hate. Math was my worst subject. I appreciate people who can make a living manipulating numbers. You know what I'm saying? Because I get headaches. So we're gonna thank you. We got to wrap it up now, but we want to thank you, Queen, for your contribution to hip hop. NE City Disco, the second all female hip hop crew in hip hop history. You were part of that, along with Baby D and a couple of other people that you described. Baby D was a member of both groups, and she told her story. But Miss Celia Powell Brodus, MC High C, we want to thank you for doing our show and being gracious enough to share your time with us, which we know is very valuable because you're watching people's money for them. So we want to let you get back to doing that, but we wanted to highlight your story and let you know that hip-hop will never forget you, okay?
Thank you.
Our interviews are archived on our website, free to the public, just by the click of a link. They can hear your story from now until. We don't bury the interviews and put them away. It's on our website, which will be up forever, and your story is going to be cataloged on there. In fact, you're running today's show. You're going to be on with MC Debbie D. So it's a perfect match. You guys go way back to the very beginning, and you're closing out our month of honoring the queens of the culture. Okay?
Thank you.
Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop, MC High C, Miss Celia Powell Brodus, coming at you. Peace.
Hello. I'm Robin Lynn Maven, the CEO, creator, and producer of Vibes Live. We have over 2 million geographical listeners reaching 200 countries with nonstop music 24/7. Just tune in on VibesLive.com.
Hello out there, Disco Daddy here. Welcome to another edition of Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop. If you've been following us, you know that all September we've been honoring true queens of our culture, hip hop culture, which is now a worldwide culture. Okay? Many of these ladies' stories have never been heard. Okay, and we're going to change that because in this age of the internet, there's information out there that is helpful to young artists and a historian. And hip-hop being the only genre in which most of the founders and original pioneers are still living, it's important to get this information down from the horse's mouth, so to speak. Okay, we're not making anything up. We don't edit our shows. We don't sell our shows. Our shows are available with the click of the link forever on our website, and so that is Wide World of Hip Hop for anyone interested in the knowledge and the history of these pioneers and legends. Today, our final show for September, we honor a very special queen of the culture, MC Debbie D. And she's one of the few ladies who has a very unique story touching on many different facets of the history of hip hop. And we're going to sit back and listen to her narrative. We do have some interesting clips, audio clips of certain moments in her life that are of interest not only to people who love hip hop, but historians. Again, we want the true history of our people laid down, and only the people who created the history can do that. So today, on Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop, we have MC Debbie D. How are you doing, Queen?
I am doing well, DJ Disco Daddy. Thank you so much for this opportunity to share some information about myself and also about the hip-hop culture. I appreciate being on your program tonight.
Okay. So what we're going to do, our show is narrative. We're not hit with 30 million questions. You start with your early life, what it was like growing up, where you were born, what the flavor was around you, what was going on, park jams, the schools, the clubs, everything that sort of as a teenager drew you and hundreds of thousands of others into this new musical form, which later became hip-hop. Start with your early life and try to, I may interrupt you every now and then and just pin down what year was that, Debbie D, so that we get a chronology, which goes along with all the other interviews that we've done. You have a slice of the hip hop pie, your story. When people listen to all of the interviews in total, they get the whole pie, and everything sort of matches up as far as the years. You get a complete chronology of what was going on in hip hop before and after record. So, MC Debbie D, you got the floor.
Okay, well, thank you so much. Well, first of all, let me just say, again, thank you so much for having me. And my backstory is, unlike most pioneers of the hip-hop culture, I wasn't born in the Bronx. I was actually born in Harlem. So I want to give a shout-out to Harlem. Okay, well, that's where I was born. And what happened was in 1976, we had a fire in our building. I was in junior high school at the time. And because we had gotten burned out, we wound up moving to the Bronx. So in 1976, I moved to the Bronx on the west side. And then my mother got an opportunity to move over to the east side to Webster Houses, which is located on 168th Street and Webster Avenue. So that was 1977. And at that time, I was in transition, just getting ready to graduate from junior high school and go to high school, which was Norman Thomas. And you know how it is in the projects. It's, you know, the summer is here, the windows are open, and, you know, that's a typical project environment. And one day, I heard this music, and I'm thinking, what is that? Now, I'm on the 19th floor. So I heard this loud music. And I decided, you know what, let me go downstairs and follow this music. And I came downstairs, and it was right there in what we call the middle building, because everybody knows when you have projects, it's usually like a cluster. And so in the middle building was where the DJ was. This was DJ Formalo, DJ Abel. They were kind of like right there. So I just kind of stood there, and I watched, and I saw a few people kind of just get on the mic and things like that. And I was like, wow, I want to do that. Mm. So what I did was I told my brother about it. And so my brother came downstairs, and he started watching, and we went upstairs, and we started writing rhymes. So I actually became an MC in 1977. And at that particular time, you really didn't have a lot of crews. You know, you had a lot of people basically just kind of feeling their way, you know, kind of moving in different areas and stuff like that. And so I would just kind of come downstairs and say, hey, you know, can I get on your mic? And so the guy was kind enough to let me get on. DJ Formalo, who is still around today, and so I would just kind of just get on the mic. From there, very interestingly.
Wait. Let me. Yes. I will interrupt you here because I must ask you. It's very important. You, your eyes and ears are still back there. Who you went upstairs and started writing rhymes? Now I've interviewed Raheem and I've interviewed Keith Trio, and up to 1977. The people were doing nursery rhymes and things like that. He said, if you watch this brother Melly Mel, watch, write the first rhyme. So you guys went upstairs to write rhymes. What, where, what point was this? Was there people at that point then writing original rhymes? In other words, what inspired you to go up and even have a concept of writing rhymes? Did you see someone else do original rhymes at this period? What you're talking about, 1977?
1977, okay, yeah, you know, I kind of just saw people like in the neighborhood, you know, just kind of just get on the mic and say a couple of things. You know, again, I'm not from the Bronx, so I don't really know anybody. You know what I'm saying? I'm 13 years old, so I don't really know anybody.
Right.
And I'm just kind of like, you know, watching and seeing what's going on. I didn't have any family in the Bronx. We got there because we got burnt out. And so, you know, when I saw that and saw the music, the crowd, the young people, you know, I said to myself, I kind of want to do that. And so what I did was, again, I went upstairs. I told my brother about it. And so, you know, we kind of just hung around and just kind of watched. And then we decided to write our own rhymes. Now, at that particular time, rhymes at that time was basically about what was going on. So one of the things that me and my brother did is we put a routine together about young girls wearing Jordache, wearing jeans and all the different jeans that they were wearing at that time, Jordache and Sassoon and Gloria Vanderbilt. And then we also talked about the sneakers that the kids wore. Now, remember, this is all young people because hip-hop at this time, young people are not wearing shoes. We're not going to clubs because we're only 13 and 14 years old.
And it's not even called hip-hop yet.
Exactly, exactly. We kind of, we called them jams. We just called them jams.
Okay.
So whenever somebody kind of hear, you know, anything old school, it was basically just called a jam. And so you said, oh, such and such is that jamming, and you kind of just went to the jam. So me and my brother put this routine together, which I think you have a clip. So this would be a good time to play that because, they, you know, your audience can
you
get
too.
A chance to hear that clip.
Okay, I think we do have a clip in my mind.
Just because you get good, just because you get good.
Wow. So
history.
There you
I mean, now, this is for that to have survived from what year was that?
That was actually probably about 78, 79. And,
that was my first crew.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. You know, hip hop started in 1973 with Cool Herc and all of that. So that was kind of like around 1978, 79. We put a little routine together. My first crew, let me say this, which my brother was a part of, is DJ Patty Duke and the Jazzy Five MCs. I know most people know that there are two Jazzy Five MCs, which was in Bronx River. I think the other crew was like Bronx River or Soundview. I'm not exactly sure, but I know they were on the other side of town, but we were also the Jazzy Five MCs on the other side. So you had that going on sometimes. People kind of had the same name of the same crews, but we were DJ Patty Duke and the Jazzy Five MCs. So from that time, what happened was, again, I go to high school. I go to Norman Thomas High School. I did not go to any Bronx school. Because my school, you know how it is in New York, you pick your high school in junior high. So by the time we move to the Bronx and then we move over to Webster Avenue, my high school is already picked out. So that's why I didn't
what
go
year,
to
What year is this, Debbie?
I'm going
what
to high school in 1977 in September.
77, okay.
77,
now,
yep.
Did you, by this point, have you seen MC Sharrock? Was she known?
No, I didn't. Nope, I did not know any other female, especially in 1977. However, the point I was gonna, I was also gonna just include in that area that I was in. Any historian know that basically, as young people, you were in your particular area, and it was predominantly the area that you lived in. So, in my area, a Cool Herc came in my area. He was at the other end of Webster, and he was also up on Washington Avenue, which was one block over from where I lived, and we called it the 9 because it was 169th Street. So Cool Herc was up there, and also DJ Clark Kent, because Clark Kent was his DJ. And we had this conversation, as a matter of fact, Cool Herc and I, maybe about last year. And he said, I remember you because you had on glasses. And I was like, you remember that? Oh, my God. Because I didn't wear them to high school. You know, when you go to high school, you kind of want to look cute and all of that. So I wasn't trying to wear my glasses. But that summer, I still had them on. So, you know, that was basically what happened around that particular time, 77, 78. You know, that was the people in my area. And in regard to girls, the girl, I believe the first female MC I met when I first started was actually Pebbly Poo. Because Pebbly Poo was connected to Cool Herc, and he was in that area. See, I didn't know anything about going uptown. I didn't even know how to get uptown. I'm only 13, 14 years old, so I didn't even know how to get up there, and I didn't go to any of the schools. And so I kind of, like I said, you know, I was exposed to Cool Herc, and then I became exposed to the Mean Gene and the L Brothers with Grand Wizard Theodore, because they were up on Boston Road in 63 Park. So all of this is basically happening around the year 1977, 78. That's basically the furthest I moved. Exactly, was in
just
that particular
records.
Area.
Okay.
And so, well, you go ahead. Whatever question you wanted to have about that.
Basically, you one of the few artists who transcends both eras, before records and after. I don't know if I'm pushing your story forward, but I want to ask you what happened? What was the impact, psychological, economic, and everything, all of a sudden when records started being made? You guys have been doing this all your lives for the past few years for fun. Now, recording contracts. What happened then? And what effect did it have on Debbie D?
In regard to recordings, I'm skipping over a few things, so let me just backtrack a little bit.
Don't do that. Keep that question. I don't want to interrupt your narrative, but I just want to keep you to have that in your head because, you see, artists like you, you're the only people who can illuminate the change. Nothing else has happened in any other part of America like this. You see what I'm saying? So when the recording contract came out, and you're one of the few people who was already in the game before recording contract, it must have had an effect on you, and your all of a sudden this ain't
well, it had a major
anymore.
Effect. It had a major effect because what recordings did was it made hip hop much more commercial, and it also because you started having record companies, A&R, people are scouting, they're looking for different groups.
Showing
and so what
shows,
happened was
looking at groups, okay. Right.
Exactly. And so what happened was a lot of the crews now are not necessarily in a jam anymore. For the most part, we're in clubs. And because we're in clubs and we're in parties, people are scouting. And so what MCs and crews did was they upped their showmanship. So now you had a different dress. Now you have the routines are much sharper.
This is the meat and potatoes of what happened. Go ahead. Yeah, this is what I needed to get from you as a client.
Right. You started to see the transition of the crews become to really take their craft much more seriously. Not that we didn't before, but it was more so just kind of like in the park. We were much younger. But now, again, when people really started to consider a record contract, then it was like, okay, well, you know what? We want to make sure we're tighter. And then the record company pushed you when it came to your showmanship, you know, into your look, what you wore, your presentation, how to connect with the crowd. You see what I'm saying?
Exactly.
So it definitely brought a transition, and I also got a chance to make several records, which most people don't know, but, you know, we're going to get into that, and you'll get a chance to kind of hear more about
it. Go back to where you left off. That's a bomb you dropped there, and this is what this show is about, not just your history, but the flavor, what was going on. You see, people can image now in their minds that period of hip-hop, because a lot of people, Debbie D., think hip-hop just bam was here and all the elements were here at the same time, DJs and you know what I'm saying, just appeared. You and people like yourself, queens of the culture who were there from the very first day, have stories and knowledge. So continue, please, Miss Debbie D. on Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip-Hop.
Okay. Well, from there, from my Patty Duke and the Jazzy 5 MCs, we merged with the crew called K Connection. And this consisted of DJ Kenny Ken, who also had a sound system, and we merged with him. And this is kind of what you had. I'm looking at some flyers in front of me. So this is like 1980, 1981.
Okay.
We kind of merged with him.
And you had a lot of blast by this time.
Exactly. You know, again,
Curtis
now people kind of
after Flash, right? Okay.
Sure. Right now, you have more people kind of going inside. We were still kind of doing a few jams here and there, but we were also even going inside. You know, this is where the PAL came in at. This is the Ecstasy Garage.
Okay.
This is we're still in the grassroots. This is the T Connection.
Right.
You know, this is the Sparkle. Right. You know, these are all the major areas. Even around the Nine, we had like Claremont Center. You know, was another area that another place we went, and so this is where the group merged. So you got Jazzy 5 merging with Kenny Ken because he had a sound system. Let me say something about this because I don't know if people talk about this enough, but the DJs that had a sound system, the DJs that had a sound system always had much more notoriety than other DJs. So oftentimes when people talk about DJs, you hear the same names over and over because these DJs had sound systems, and guess what? The young kids followed the sound system. So, and let me say this.
Systems you're talking about, standout sound systems.
Exactly.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, what I was going to say to you is oftentimes people that are historians or they're really trying to get into the culture and understand some things about the sound system, one of the names that always comes up are the Herculoids. And oftentimes people think that the Herculoids are the people that was with Kool Herc. But the Herculoids was the sound system. So, and Kool Herc was known for having an amazing sound system. You can hear his sound system for blocks.
I got you. No, I got you. But It's like they were calling her. What connection did they have with Cool Herc?
I'm sorry?
If they were calling Herculoids, you say they weren't actually Cool Herc was separate from the Herculoids, or they just
what I'm saying is when people say the Herculoids, whenever they use that name, they often think that the Herculoids are people. The Herculoids were not necessarily people. The Herculoid, that particular word, was applicable to the sound system, his sound system. That was his sound. You know, sometimes people kind of just gave their sound system a name. And a lord is the person that is over everybody. So what Cool Herc is saying is, my sound system is better than everybody.
I was thinking the Herculoids were part of the group with Clark Kent, his group.
Exactly.
So you just, again, dropped the bomb that illuminates that that was not the, that's a misconception.
Right. Now Clark Kent, Coke LaRock, Timmy Tim, all of these people were a part of Cool Herc's group.
Right.
But what I'm saying to you is when they say the Herculoids, if you ask Cool Herc or if you ask DJ Clark Kent or Coke LaRock, they're going to say to you that the Herculoids was the sound system.
Okay. I have it.
Okay, so that's a good nugget right there for people that want to know history.
Okay.
Anybody want to know history?
Okay.
And let me say this. So then you had Mean Gene and the L Brothers, a sound system. You had Bam Bottle, who had a sound system. You had Disco King Mario, who had a sound system. You see what I'm saying? Then you had Breakout, who had a sound system. So you had all of these local DJs all over the place. But the people that had major sound systems that they could come out in the park and they could really plug into that light pole and you could hear their sound system from a blocks away, those are the people that are usually most notable in hip-hop. But
let
you had all
you
kinds
this.
Of DJs out there. I mean, I'm sorry?
If you had these massive sound systems, people could hear blocks away, what was police doing? I mean, they didn't have any I have to ask you that because it's the first thing that comes to mind, you know, because you're clearly stating that they were DJs that had massive sound systems with different, you know, that separated them from the ordinary run-of-the-mill DJ. So what kind of, did you have problems with the police?
That's a great question. That's a great question. No, because what happened was whenever they went into the parks, they set it up in a park. It wasn't like it was out in the street. And oftentimes, like you will hear somebody say, 63 park or 55 park. Or what's another park I can think? 23 park. Oftentimes what people don't realize is the numbers that they use was actually equated to a school. It wasn't a park like with trees and they had a lake and they had – it wasn't in seats. It wasn't like that. 63 park was 63 school. It was just that they were in the schoolyard. And so we would just say – we would say something like there's a jam in 63 park.
Right.
You follow me?
Word would get around faster than the internet.
Oh, let me tell you, word would get around faster than Facebook. Are you kidding me? And you could hear it. Now you have to remember this, Disco Danny. We 13 and 14 years old. Everybody's basically walking on their bike. So when somebody would say, and let me just plug this. Oftentimes, the word got around because people lived in projects, and so they would spread the word really quickly. Or people got the word in high school. And so they would come to the high schools and pass out flyers, and they would say, like, we're going to be in this park this particular day. But for the most part, when they're in a jam, that was usually by word of mouth. And guess what? When they set up in that park, and you – now, I want you to picture this. You a 13-year-old kid, a 14-year-old kid, right? You hear that music about three blocks away. Trust me when I tell you, you start walking faster than you ever walked in your life. Because you were trying to get to that park because you wanted to see Grand Wizard Theodore do his thing. You wanted to see Flash do his thing. You wanted to see Clark Kent do his thing. You wanted to see these DJs.
Okay.
So you were moving.
Were
like
you a B
really,
girl?
Really
were you a B girl, Debbie D?
Oh no, I was never a B girl. I'm always a fly girl.
You were never,
never
a B girl, okay? Because some
never
of some
B girl,
of our
always a fly girl.
Work.
I can't be spinning on my head. That's not for me. Salute to all my sisters. All my sisters was doing that little break dancing and spinning, but Debbie D is a fly girl for life.
That's
but that's how it was. That's how
okay.
it was. The word kind of got around, and you know, and all of the kids just went. We would wear our sweatshirts, and that little clip you just heard, you know, everybody, the girls would wear their Sassoon jeans. Even if you saw some of the old school flyers, you know, and you would see mm-hmm. like Buddy Esquire or Cisco Kid, these, you know, were people that would make a lot of our flyers. You would see them depict
okay.
girls with those types of jeans on. You know, and the,
okay.
and the party was like $2 for girls, $3 for boys. And then it was like, if the fly girls got there before 12, you know, they would get in free. You know what I'm saying?
Okay.
So it was just
right.
a great time. It was the greatest
okay.
time ever of the hip-hop era is old school.
Wow.
It's old school. So let me move on a little bit. If I can move on a little bit, let me move
Please,
on.
Please, you're dropping bombs, MC Debbie
okay,
D.
Okay,
okay.
Well, I'm
so
glad
that is
you appreciate
world
it.
Continue. Please. Go ahead.
Okay. So now, after, you know, again, Jazzy 5 and K Connection, we're at the T Connection. Very notable place. Very, very notable.
In the Bronx.
I mean, you
Bronx,
wanted to
in the Bronx,
get into the T Connection. You wanted
Bronx,
to get into the T Connection. I'm sorry?
Where was it located? Bronx or
the T Connection was up in the Bronx. The
okay.
All of the clubs for the most part in the early days of hip hop. Now I'm talking 79, you know, 78, 79,
mm-hmm.
80. For the most
mm-hmm.
part, everything is happening in the Bronx. For the most part.
Okay.
You may have had some
okay.
pockets in Harlem, maybe Queens, Brooklyn, but the thrust of it is happening in the Bronx.
Mm-hmm.
We're at places like the PAL on Webster Avenue. We're at the T Connection,
right.
which is uptown. You have
okay.
The Ecstasy Garage, which was on Webster Avenue. So most of the
mm-hmm.
early flyers you would see,
mm-hmm.
you would see us at those places. And at that time, this
okay.
is Patty Duke and the Jazzy 5, and we're playing
mm-hmm.
at these spots. And let me say this. This
mm-hmm.
is at the time
mm-hmm.
when groups, believe it or not, and we're only like, because I'm still in high school, so we're only like maybe 16, 17 years old. Even at that time, we even at a young age, we had a spirit of entrepreneurship. And the reason why I say that
right.
is because a lot of crews started incorporating a manager.
You
had people like
your business infrastructure together. Yeah.
Exactly. Because
mm-hmm.
things are picking up now and you're moving to certain
mm-hmm.
areas. And so people would say,
mm-hmm.
hey, I'll be your promoter or, you know, I'll be your manager. You know, so
right.
we're young, but we had that entrepreneur spirit. Like when you had your flyers, you was hitting the high schools with your flyers, the projects with your
right.
flyers. You know, so you were moving around because you were really trying to push your name out. Now, remember, there is
right.
no social media, and guess what? There's not even radio.
No. I
it's
remember
not
I
even on the radio. We're not
the
even
index cards.
I'm sorry?
I remember the index cards in Harlem and for the parties on the weekend. I noticed it. We didn't have an internet, but we had index cards.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But you did
you know,
not have radio, and
period.
That's very key.
Right,
the
no
fact
Facebook
that we didn't have radio.
Like that, right.
And exactly, and that's one of the reasons why the flyers came into play. Because what happened
mm-hmm.
was each member of their crew would take, you know, 300 flyers to their school in their neighborhood and pass them out. You
right.
know, I'm sitting here looking at all of my flyers now, you know, and all on different
mm-hmm.
colored paper and all of that. And you would have all these names
wow.
and all of that. And we would just go out and we would pass our flyers out because we wanted
wow.
people to come to our parties. You know, we would really try to build
mm-hmm.
our reputation on our crews and what we did. So it was an amazing
okay.
time.
Another,
you know,
another question I gotta ask you here. How
sure.
did you guys make money? When you say crews and you're passing out flyers and stuff like that, were they did you charge at the parks? Who collected the money? How did that whole system work to benefit you economically? I
oh,
know
well,
you're
that's a great question, too.
That, economically, how did that work?
I don't know what we're getting some feedback there. Unfortunately, yeah. Believe it or not, we didn't make a lot of money. You're talking about the late 70s, early 80s. And when I say early 80s, I mean 80, 81, 82. This time period is basically from 77 to 82. And what you have is parties where they were charging $2, $3. You know, the girls were getting free. Mm-hmm. That type of thing. And so what would happen is at the end of the day, you would look to your manager or you would look to whoever recruited you to actually have the party. People will call you and say, I'd like to put the Jazzy Five on the flyer. You know, can you come to this party? And we would say something like, okay, well, we charge you $200. Well, all the time, you really didn't get that $200. You were here a lot. I use the term, we got jerked.
Oh boy!
You would hear that term a lot, and that's what they mean. They mean by the time we got finished sweating and doing the party, and we waited when the party was over, we didn't get our money. But you know what? At the end of the day, next week we was right back.
Right.
Because that was our outlet. That's what we did, and we loved to do what we did.
Right. Right.
Yeah,
that's
so we didn't really make a lot of money. I often say, Disco Daddy, that we didn't get the money, but we got the wealth. And when I say that, what I basically mean is the wealth of knowledge about one of the greatest genre of music of the 21st century. Nobody can give the historicity to the culture of hip-hop like the Pioneers. We didn't get the money, but we did get the wealth of knowledge. And anybody that wants to know what happened at that particular time in the grassroots and the genesis of hip-hop, the Pioneers are the people that you want to target. People like myself. When you want to know about that history, people like myself is the people you want to talk to. Because we can tell it to you. There's a wealth of information we can share. Because coming into like you said, the records and the movies, all of that came later. Mm-hmm. We were already in 10 years before something like that even came up.
Right. This is one of the most interesting conversations I have ever had with anyone that I've interviewed because you have a wealth of knowledge. Now, we've eaten up 30 minutes. So
okay.
You had some other information and edits to share. We can go on.
We can go on, that's fine. I'm enjoying myself.
Then let's continue because we want to get all your information out there. And you thought you couldn't do an hour, Debbie D. Shame on you. You could do hours and hours.
I've been talking all my life.
So
that's what
continue.
I do. They pay me
please,
to talk.
Okay. Please continue with this story. You're listening to Debbie D., one of the queens of our culture on Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop. Continue, my sister.
So,
You left off talking about the change and how everybody was just excited to get out there and do their shows and everything like that. And we got into a series of records. I don't know where you left off yourself. Is there a place where you'd like to continue to go on so we can get your other edits in there?
Okay. So let me share this.
I know I've taken you off track.
No. I'm clear. I have some notes in front of me. But one of the things that happened around 1980, 81, and a lot of pioneers can talk about this too. You had a lot of transition going on in groups. A lot of groups started breaking up. Now, it was a very pivotal time because you have to remember, Disco Daddy, a lot of us started in 76, 77, 78, 79, and we did this every week.
Right.
We didn't do like three shows a year. We did when we did a jam or we went to go MC at a jam. That was, remember, if you're in the summertime, you could literally be doing a jam three and four times a week.
Right.
So, and I say that because I want to give a clear picture to people. By the time you put in a good 7 years of that and doing it on the weekends and then doing it in the parks, you know, we're young, so now we want to make more money. We tired. People start going off to college. People start, transition happened. And so that transition happened for me as well. One of the things that happened was I was in an all-male group, like all of the female MCs. We were in all-male groups with the exception of the Mercedes ladies. And so then my group kind of broke up, and then my manager at the time said, you know what, Debbie, there's a girl who's a DJ I think you should meet because I think you two can pair together very well. And I said, oh, okay. And so, unbeknown to me, Cool Herc, she was working with him, and he said to her, you need to meet MC Debbie D. She's great. Y'all two need to hook up, okay? Wow. So believe it or not, we eventually met, and then I became the first female soloist performing on a stage ever. Wow. That was something you did not see with a routine, with the clothes. You know what I'm saying? Literally standing on the stage as the only girl doing that.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
And so that was like the end of 81, going into from 81 up into 83. You had MC Debbie D and DJ Wanda D. We became what they coined the ladies of the 80s. And I'm telling you, that was amazing. That was amazing. At that time, let me also say this, around that time, hip-hop now started opening up, and we're really moving now from the Bronx, coming down to what we call money-making Manhattan. And one of the major, major spots that all of the crews went to was Harlem World. Anybody will
Which
tell you.
Which is located where in Harlem?
It was located on 116th Street and Lenox Avenue, right in front of the train station. Major spot. You wanted to play there. Mm-hmm. You had to play there.
Mm-hmm.
You was praying to play there.
The Apollo of hip-hop. The Apollo of hip-hop. The Apollo
it was the Apollo of hip-hop. Exactly. So the T-Connection was the major spot in the Bronx, and then Harlem World became the spot in Harlem. As a matter of fact, this is the very spot where the most iconic battle took place between the Cold Crush and the Fantastic Five, and I was one of those girls standing in the audience watching that battle.
What year? When did this happen?
I think it was 81, 82. I can't exactly remember, but it was one of those years because they did it and then they did it again. So it was 81, 82.
Okay.
But that was the battle with the Cold Crush and the Fantastic Five. And it was at Harlem World. So Harlem World was a very pivotal place in regard to the history of hip-hop and what happened in the early 80s. Everybody played there. And myself and Wanda D played there. As a matter of fact, I think you have a clip of that. People can find that on YouTube. If you like to play a little bit of that, you could do that.
Let's see if we got that clip queued up. Robin? Robin Lynn? Oh, there we go.
That was 1982, I think. That part was about 82.
Okay.
I met Wanda at the end of 81.
Just, let's just illuminate this. That during this period, groups dominated. You were basically, just like Curtis Blow, a single rapper was unique at that time.
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay.
And if you look at some of the old school flyers, oftentimes we had battles or we also had award ceremonies. And they would have like a list of the soloists. So you would see my name. You would see Spoonie G. You would see Curtis Blow. You would see Love Bug Starsky. You would see Busy B Starsky. I can't remember everybody, but those were like the main names you would see. And I'm looking at all of my flyers. because I got them all. Mm. I always tell people
can
I
you,
got
can you, let me ask you, you may not know the answer to this. Where did the concept of even pitting one DJ against another or one rapper against another battling, which is another level of hip-hop, if you can understand where I'm trying to get to from the foundation. Mm-hmm. Had people been battling before records, before the period, or was this something new that came about after the period of records started coming?
We were battling before records came along. Battles were very helpful because, believe it or not, battles drew a crowd. Mm-hmm. So
okay.
You would want to come see one of the most notable battles was like Wiz Kid and Theodore. Or you would see you would even see like the Herculoids or, you know, Kool Herc and his group battling, Bambaataa's group.
Okay.
Yeah, you know,
but
sometimes
then again, that's sound system against sound system. Right.
Exactly. Sometimes it was the sound system, and sometimes it was about the DJ.
We were
kids, so we just became very creative, you know, whatever we could use. Mm-hmm. There were battles even with girls. Like, I have a flyer that's got some of the girls on it. One of my flyers, I won the battle, I'm proud to say.
Right.
Because I was very lyrical. But, you know, I have one of those flyers. But we had a lot of battles during that time because that helped to draw a crowd. People would come, just like people do things today. You have the B-boys battling. You have the DJs battling. You have the MCs battling. You had the sound systems battling. You know, the DJ scratching. Oh, yeah. I mean, we had it going on. I'm telling you, when we say peace, love, unity, and having fun, we meant that.
Mm-hmm. The concept of battling then was entrenched from the very basic beginning of hip-hop basics.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay.
100%.
These are bombs. These are bombs, Debbie D. These are things.
Oh, you're very welcome.
People who were there, the eyewitness, could tell us about.
Let me say this in regard to the battle and in regard to DJs, because most people know, and maybe you may have some listeners that don't know, but I do think this deserves a plug. Grand Wizard Theodore is the young man that created the ability to scratch a record. Now, when he did that, I'm not exactly sure how old he was. He's a little bit younger than me. You know, I know his older brothers, but Theodore is the youngest brother. But the reason I want to point that out is because Theodore was he was very young with this, maybe about 15 years old. And here's the thing. When he did that at a park. He was in 63 Park. Now, I want you to picture this. Front of the jam where the DJ is, because they're trying to figure out, what is he doing?
I can see the first time people are hearing a scratch, right.
Exactly. You had never heard it. You heard them, you know, mixing records, you know. People would be lifting up their leg and, you know. I mean, they had all kind of tricks.
63 Park, what year?
Oh, this is all between, this is probably 78, 79. You know, if you ask him, I'm sure he could coin it better for you. But I know it was definitely in the summertime because all of this is before. Oh, yeah, this is way before records.
Okay.
I'm telling you. And so I just thought that was so poignant because when you had battles, like the DJs would do their tricks. And that was just so amazing. I can't even express to you enough, Disco Daddy, as a teenager, when you saw these things, how you ran back home and told your friends, or you went to the school, whatever high school, we were all in high school. I'm sure every narrative you heard, everybody kept saying they were in high school. And so you ran to the high school the next day like, yo, was you at the jam? Did you see Flash? Did you see Diddle? Did you see Clark Kent? Did you see Wiz Kid? Did you see Jazzy J? Red Alert?
And that's how they're saying it.
It was amazing to see these guys. That was amazing. And I was just blessed because I had a girl DJ that was able to do that. When you listen to that clip, you will hear Wanda D scratching the record. So here we have, and at this particular time when we're at Harlem World, anybody that follows me on social media, on Twitter or Facebook, MC Debbie D, they'll see pictures. So you'll see us like in our outfits. You know, like we started upping our game because this is now 82. So you got to get your showmanship together. You just, and particularly as a girl, you just can't get up there and you don't know what you're doing.
Right.
You had to know what you're doing. You had to be able to connect with the crowd. You can't say a rhyme and then 30 seconds later say, yes, yes, y'all. No, you couldn't do that. When people listen to that full clip, what they hear is 5 minutes, me emceeing 5 minutes straight. I don't think any other girl had ever done that. And that's only 5 minutes that you hear. I literally, our routine was about 12 to 15 minutes long. So I don't think any girl had ever done that that I knew about or I've seen, but, hey, I'm always open to receipts. Show me what you, what you got.
Right.
But that was phenomenal, you know, to be able to see that. But Disco Daddy, we had to do that. Now you got the Cold Crush. You got the Crash Crew. You got the Feel It Four. You're not just in the Bronx. You in Harlem.
Hard hitters, yeah.
Exactly. You in Harlem, like you coming up against Master Don and the Def Committee. I mean, you had some amazing groups during that particular time. So if you're going to step on the stage, you had to know what you were doing. Wanda and I often say, were the contemporary to AJ, DJ AJ, and Busy B. We were their contemporary because you had a DJ and an MC.
Right.
Okay. And so we went up there and we did our thing, and we did that for a few years. We did extremely well. We are featured on a lot of flyers. We traveled all over the tri-state area, which is New York City, New Jersey, and Connecticut. We had an amazing manager, Armstrong. Unfortunately, we didn't get all our money, but we got the wealth.
Okay. All right. You're listening to Debbie D, MC Debbie D, one of the queens of our culture. And only she can tell you some of the things she's telling you. She's dropping knowledge on Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop. Continue, my sister.
Okay, so again, so, you know, I'm doing a lot of things, you know, as a soloist and building my career and all of that. Wanda and I are, you know, really the face for girls at that particular time. We were most prominent, you know, all of that is featured on flyers. Any flyers you see during that time, you'll mainly see our names on them. And then, again, you had transition with a lot of groups, But you have to remember, when I say that, what I mean is, you know, groups started breaking up, people started, you know, going to college or whatever it is they were going to do. But you have to remember, when they started in 76 77, they had already put in 8 years, 9 years of doing this on a consistent basis. So you got to understand the time frame that we're in, and just them doing that over and over and over. So by this particular time, I was approached by Lisa Lee and Sha Rock to join forces with them and create a girl group. They didn't have their group anymore. And so they, you know, they placed a phone call to me. I thought it was a great idea. We were the most popular girls in the tri-state area. And so I said, hey, this is a great idea.
What year is this?
This is late 83.
Okay. Good.
This is late 19. As a matter of fact, you know what? It's not late. It's summer 1983. And the reason why I can quote it specifically is because what a lot of people don't know is they know us by the name Us Girls, but before we were called Us Girls, we were actually called Empress. And we were called Empress. That was the name of the group. There was a piece of paper that Lisa had written out that said Empress on it, and it is dated 1983. I'm a stickler for details. So, you know.
We're glad because if you survive, your story survives, and we would never know any of this.
I'm a stickler for details.
How specific your information is, we would never know any of this. And these are bombs. When you listen to your interview yourself, you realize you eliminated a whole lot of information. We appreciate you. Continue, Queen.
Okay, so they came to me, you know, I accepted that offer and said, okay, you know, I'll hook up with these ladies. I knew, you know, we could do a lot together. You know, all three of our names were prolific in the culture. You know, we were very well respected. We were lyrical in our rhymes, our presentation, our showmanship. It was a winner. It was a winner. Okay. And so me and Wanda merged with them. Wanda D did start with us for a few months, you know, and then she kind of went on her own. And then the offer came right on the heels of that for us to come into B Street. Harry Belafonte decided he was going to do a movie.
The film B Street.
I'm sorry?
The film B Street. Some of our audience is very young.
Okay.
We have to illuminate everything, what Beach Street was about, what it represented at that point in a new genre being created in New York City called hip-hop.
Okay, well, Beach Street is a movie that the legendary and activist and actor, Harry Belafonte, decided he was going to produce. He wanted to showcase this new genre called hip-hop. So he connected with Kool Herc and whoever he merged with, you know, and I guess they talked about various groups that should be featured in the movie. And so when you look at that movie, you, for the most part, will see many of the pioneers that were, you know, if I could say, most prolific at that particular time.
At the same time,
I need to say this, a year before that was also a movie or a documentary, some people may call it, called Wild Style. And in Wild Style, you also have pioneers in that. That was produced by Charlie Ahern.
Okay.
And so now the offer, again, getting back to B Street, an offer comes up. Let me go here. The movie is being produced. They're filming and everything. We wasn't in the movie.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We found out about the movie. Me, Lisa, and Shaw found out about the movie. And we said, you know what we're going to do? We're going to go down there and talk to them about putting us in the movie. Because we said they can't do a movie without girls in it. And if they're going to have girls, it's going to be us girls.
There you go.
And so we went on the set, and we talked to them about being in that movie. And guess what happened? The rest is history. We're in the movie.
Wow.
And so that was amazing because the first time you ever see women in hip-hop on screen, on film, you see the Us Girls. That movie plays all over the world still today.
Wow. Wow.
Because it was
and
the first.
And that's Us Girls, they seeing you, Lisa Lee, and MC
Debbie
Sharrock.
D. Yep, Debbie D, Sharrock, and Lisa Lee are the three girls called the Us Girls. And we sang a song in that movie, and we rapped in the movie as well. And the song was Us Girls Can Boogie Too. And because of the title of the song, we decided we'd just be called the Us Girls. And so that's how that name came about.
Okay.
And so from there, you know, we did the movie, and, you know, we did very well with that. We got a chance to tour in Europe, and, you know, we did a lot in, you know, throughout the city and, you know, different features and stuff like that. It was amazing. And some, one of the things I love about it is that movie and us being on film sparked a lot of women all over the world to get into the culture. You had other groups. You had other females out there because this is 1984. So you had other women, but you didn't see them on a film across the world.
Right.
See, that's a little bit different. It's one thing to be local. It's another thing to be international. So we were the first girls that made an international mark in hip-hop.
Now, that's history. Okay.
And so that was
and that's
amazing,
the period.
You know?
This is the period of MTV and videos being made and hip hop
is becoming much more commercial now. It's becoming much more commercial.
So
we're featured in the film.
What did the film do for you guys?
Oh my goodness! What did it not do? It made us famous.
No.
What did it not do? It made us famous. As a matter of fact, this is one of the reasons why myself and the other young ladies are coined hip-hop matriarchs. We are the mothers of this culture. You know, we are the women that started in 1976, 1977. Most women that have basically go all the way back to the beginning of hip-hop is going to fall between the years of 76 to 78, the latest.
Okay.
And us three girls definitely fall between 76 and 77. And, you know, every woman for the most part, and particularly in other countries, you know, other languages, you know, those girls are standing on our shoulders because we were the first girls they saw. And again, let me say, mm-hmm. it doesn't mean that other girls wasn't out there.
Right. Right.
It just simply means that they saw us on a wider scale. You understand what I'm saying?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, so we certainly accredit all the other sisters that were out there doing what they did and all of their achievements. I do. Because we all
we've got about we've got about 7 or 8 minutes.
Okay.
I'm not sure if we're going to get the other two edits in and if that will upset me, but if you want to continue, because I would like to get into what you're doing now. And how your life has benefited from the hip-hop influence.
Okay, before I say that, let me just add this. After Us Girls, I went back to being a soloist, and I got a wonderful opportunity to cross over into the newer crews that were coming up. And one of those crews, and one of the most prolific crews, was called the Juice Crew. This is Big Daddy Kane. This is Biz Markie. This is Shantae. This is MC Shan, Kool G Rap, you know, MC Glamorous.
Wow.
You know, I became a part of that group as well. And I actually recorded. I recorded a record called Evolution. People can look that up on YouTube. And then Marley Marr produced two of my records. Most people don't even know I did that. But he did that. It's a record called The Other Woman, and the other one is called Tom, Dick, and Harry. So I did that as well. And let me backtrack and say with Us Girls too, we did two records.
Mm-hmm.
Most people know us from the record in B Street, but we also did a record for the legendary New York City Breakers. We did that as well. A lot of people don't know that, but we did do it. So I was blessed to cover a lot of ground. I, you know, being in a crew, being a soloist, you know, a lot of people basically liked my style, my presentation, the fact that I was lyrical. And so I got a lot of opportunities to kind of move around, and I appreciate that so much. What am I doing now? Still with the mic in my hand. I am the first rapper to still with the mic in my hand doing what I'm doing.
Okay.
And so, yes.
Go ahead, about Us Girls. Did I understand it is a foundation or something that you have?
Say it again.
Is there a foundation or something like that? I don't know if I'm necessarily going to get posts with the same name. Do you work with young ladies?
Yes, I have a nonprofit organization called Us Girls Can.
Okay, please.
That name basically is a spinoff of Us Girls. And what I do is I educate and empower women and girls to utilize their voice. And so we do a lot there. People can find out about that on the website Us Girls Can. I also started the Hip Hop Ministers Alliance because I'm a preacher. And you have several rappers turned preacher, Curtis Blow, MC Glamour, Sparky D, you know. And we provide a spiritual component to the hip hop culture for those that may need somebody to marry them, to utilize them in their funeral services and or counseling, prayer. We offer those services. You know, I do a lot. You know, I'm an author. I'm a ministry coach. You know, I use my government name. So if anybody would like to Google that, they can do that at DeborahHooper.com. I am the first, I'm proud to say, hip-hop artist with an earned doctorate. So I'm really honored to be able to do that. And let me just say this. You know, I say that proudly, Disco Daddy, because remember, I started from the beginning, and at the beginning, nobody really gave us any hope to the future of hip-hop. They really didn't think that these kids had anything going. You know, the Bronx was burning. Things were just looking chaotic and crazy. But out of the ashes, I rose. You know, God blessed me to make that type of achievement. And I'm honored just to be able to give back and to help my brothers and sisters in hip-hop. Let me also say this as the time winds up. My name has been featured in the Smithsonian in D.C. And, you know, various books have my name in it. And my name is spelled Debbie and a D, not D-E-E.
Right. Right.
MC.
Are you writing
Debbie
a book?
D.
Are you planning on writing a book?
I am planning on that. I have several things in the work right now that I'm really excited about. And I believe, you know, it's all about collaboration. And so, you know, I'm doing some things. And one of the things that I do, just like I'm sharing with you, I do panel discussions on the origin of hip-hop. So I'm moving around to different universities, colleges, platforms with women talking about the origin. So if anybody would like to get in touch with me, they can just, you know, hit me on any of the social sites, MC Debbie D, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube, MC Debbie D. I'm easy to find. And they can also go to my website. Let me say that, mcdebbied.com is my website.
mcdebbied.com. You might be interested to know, Debbie D, that my producer, Robin Lynn Maven, is also a minister.
Oh, okay, great. Great. There's a lot of us out there.
Yeah.
We need people with a spiritual component.
Spreading the word of the Lord, okay? Nothing wrong with that.
Absolutely. So I often tell people, God just put the mic back in my hand. He's good like that. You know, he'll utilize
your
gift and put you on an even wider platform. But I'm honored to be able to come back around and embrace my brothers and sisters and offer the services that I have if they're in need.
Well, that's what makes you a queen of our culture. We want to honor you. We want to thank you for your contribution to hip-hop.
Thank you.
If it's possible, when the show ends, and give the mailing address to Robin Lynn Maven. We're mailing out specially printed letters of recognition, oversized, suitable for framing and putting on the wall, honoring you and recognizing you and all the ladies who contributed to the show for the month of September as true queens of the culture. Okay.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your kindness in that.
Oh, yeah. And we'll be posting them on naturally on the timeline and on our website once the printer. We had to wait. My idea originally was to post them with your picture as we did the interviews, but some of the ladies, like Quinn, she couldn't make the interview session. She still wants to do it in the future, but I didn't want to have her print it up with pain, and then some of the sisters who I'd chosen couldn't do the show.
Okay.
So now that we've got all these 10 ladies for the month of September, we'll be printing them up in the next week and mailing them out to you guys. Okay.
Well, I appreciate that.
Thank you. Thank you for your time. And
thank
little challenges we went through to get this show together to make it work. But you got a full hour of MCWD on Disco Daddy's Wide World of Hip Hop, y'all.